Welcome to Risky Business, episode 216. I am Patrick Gray. In this week's show, we'll be taking a look at SAP security with SensePost's Ian Davilliers. He's written a couple of SAP security tools you'll probably all want to play around with. As it turns out, SAP's a bit of a mess. Enterprise software? Insecure? Who'd have thunk it? But before we get into all of that, it's time to review the week's security news with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we're going to start off this week's news with a look at something we covered last week, which was the sticky situation Patrick Webster found himself in when he reported a direct object reference bug to his superannuation fund. Initially, for those of you who didn't listen to last week's show, the super fund actually contacted the police and threatened to sue him via a commercial law firm. As it turns out, that may not have been such a sensible strategy.
Well, yeah, and the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald certainly seems to be paying testament to that. They're getting absolutely savaged by our buddy Ash and Moses up there. The story has certainly developed in some fairly interesting ways. And much like we were, we predicted last week, people are popping up on Twitter saying, lol, SQL injection in their site. And other people are coming out of the woodwork saying that they spotted this particular direct object reference bug, as much as 18 months ago. But the net result seems to be that, the New South Wales Privacy Commissioner has come out and said, that this is really bad and, is demanding explanations and things. And the police seem fairly uninterested in pursuing it from their end. Really, it's looking quite bad for First State Super. Like, they've really come out of this looking like, complete dicks, frankly.
It gets worse, believe it or not, which is the Federal Privacy Commissioner has actually launched an investigation. A former staff member from First State Superannuation's IT department has come forward and claimed that internally they knew about that bug for the last couple of years. Rut-roll. Few customers have come forward, said that they've also discovered the bug. The police have dropped the investigation, saying that no crime was committed. And the Superfund yesterday afternoon put out a statement saying that it was withdrawing all legal action against Mr. Webster.
Well, that's certainly an outcome I'm sure he's pleased about. But, the real takeaway lesson is for everybody else out there in listener land. If your boss starts getting a little carried away next time you guys get owned, maybe point them at this counterexample of really what not to do.
Yeah, but I mean, they didn't even get owned. They owned themselves with a direct object reference bug that meant that if you changed one number in a URL bar, then Bob's your mother's brother. You were looking at someone else's statement. I mean, it's just absolutely hilarious. But I've never seen, this sort of stuff happens, right? But have you ever seen it backfire so spectacularly? Because I have. In 10 years of covering this stuff, I've never seen it go this wrong for a company like that.
Yeah, this is definitely, it's a beautiful backfire, and it really, like, they're doing absolutely everything they could do wrong. And it's kind of nice for once to actually see it backfire properly, because we kind of all wish it would happen. But yeah, it's nice to actually see this, getting mainstream press coverage and, the Privacy Commissioner weighing in, the police weighing in, ex-employees weighing in.
And the financial press as well, talking about how,
We saw that some investor, publication talking about them doing dumb things as well. So, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you can't tell where the egg stops and the face starts at this point.
Exactly, yeah. But it's all right. It's all right because they detected it and were notified and were already investigating when whatever.
Buddy. Well, I like how they say that they had an alert that would tell them when a member accessed another member's statement. It's like saying, yeah, we left the back door to our safe open, but we mitigated that by putting a camera there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the ex-employee they talked to, Sydney Morning Herald talked to, said that was complete bullshit. And that was, of course, my first instinct as well, because implementing a piece of code that detects whether or not the access is unauthorized and alerts you about it is pretty much the same as implementing access control in the first place.
Yes, well, it's actually, like that, but it's crackheaded and doesn't make any sense. So.
It really doesn't.
So, yeah, coverage via SC Magazine, The Register, The Sydney Morning Herald, Investor Daily, it's been on Slashdot. It was one of the most popular stories on the Sydney Morning Herald's website earlier this week. There's been several pieces now published. Anyway, I guess we'll just leave it there. But wow, I really didn't expect it to blow up quite this much.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a nice exercise in schadenfreude for all of those, all the people on this side of the fence. But sucks to be them. it may well continue to get even worse.
Sucks to be super first state superannuation, and it must feel pretty good to be Pat Webster right now. Now, interesting development. Symantec has found a sample of a bit of malware that they claim contains, like, could have only been constructed using the source code from Stuxnet. So it looks like the people who created Stuxnet have actually created this new, like, general purpose remote access Trojan, but it definitely contains Stuxnet source.
Yeah, this is really interesting. This worm, or this Stuxnet crime, they're calling it Dooku.
Yeah.
And I looked at some of the research that Symantec did, and they had this big table which described the areas of similarity between Stuxnet and Dooku. Really, it is very similar other than the payload. And the interesting thing, of course, is that this is being targeted for, as you say, general remote access and, you know, kind of data collection and reconnaissance. And if anything, you would expect that to have come before the original Stuxnet, in terms of using it for recon against control system, which is what it does appear to be targeting. It's still looking for systems that are running industrial control stuff, but then setting up for data exfiltration and remote access. Yeah, so, I mean, it's an interesting development. And of course, the another thing that you think about this is if the attribution that we've seen traditionally, which is that it's, you know, the Israeli Mossad or, you know, the US or a combination of the two, you know, you would think that lying low with the capability right now would be a smart plan rather than, you know, going straight out and using it again. And the dates that we're seeing suggest that it was built sometime around December 2010, which is after Stuxnet really had broken in the public domain. So, you know, I'm not sure whether this really corroborates the idea of it being, state-sponsored or done, you know, by governments or military contractors, because it does seem a little weird. And maybe you would think that the risk aversion would have kicked in by December 2010.
I mean, the thing that I find interesting, though, is if this thing starts popping up all over the United States, it does tend to argue against the idea that this was a US/Israel created worm. Then again, it could be disinformation. It could be seven levels of subterfuge wrapped in mystery. You know, we just don't know. But it's certainly interesting to know that whoever created Stuxnet has actually created some other stuff, and it's out there.
Well, I suppose, you know, it makes sense that, you know, if you're going to develop worms, you're not going to develop just one and stop, right? You're going to reuse your expertise. But, this is an interesting development, and it doesn't quite fit in with the rest of the picture, in my opinion, you know, what we'd established about Stuxnet. So, yeah, I'll be worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, no, definitely worth keeping an eye on, that's for sure. Now, in the not-so-funny department, is this next item. Actually, a friend of mine sent me a bit of a screen cap of this shortly after it happened.
I bet.
I don't think this is funny, personally. But some guys apparently owned up YouTube's, like Sesame Street's YouTube channel, and loaded it up with like anal porn.
Well, yeah, there's not really a whole bunch more you could say about that, is there? Yeah, I mean, I agree that you know, it's a little bit juvenile perhaps, and not supposedly the funniest thing ever, but... you know, what do you put in your risk register, really? You know, if you're a Sesame Street company, like, what do you put there? Like, you know, chance that some hacker is going to bust in and put anal porn. Severity high, likelihood low, right? Overall risk low.
I wonder what the PricewaterhouseCoopers guys had to say about that, you know? In their ring-binded report.
Oh, I see what you did there with the ring-binding joke.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Really? That should probably go on the cutting room floor, I think.
But, yeah, no, I just don't think this is particularly cool. You know, because kids, anal porn, not good, not cool.
Yeah, it's not really the combination made in heaven, is it?
No, it's not. I just don't think that was particularly funny, like, really.
No.
Now, here's an interesting one. The SEC, or Securities and Exchange Commission over there in the United States, the corporate regulator, is insisting that corporations these days now in their reports actually disclose potential security breaches, not just confirmed security breaches.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting, isn't it? Because the definition, or exactly, you know, what you consider to be potential is quite open. And I guess if you're, in a position of having to generate your SEC filings, you know, how much wiggle room you get on that, you know, may cause people to err on the side of caution and actually, you know, start to disclose more worrying things. Now, what's a potential security issue, right? That's the question, isn't it? And, you know, if you lose a bunch of data on a backup tape which wasn't encrypted and you get it back again, right, I would consider that probably a potential security issue. But, you know, if you lose it and it's encrypted but not very well, you know, is it a potential issue? There's plenty of room for weaseling, but, you know, this really is a step in the right direction. And, you know, I know that people will be, you know, mining through some of our favorite organizations' filings to see, you know, exactly what they're disclosing next time they have to. And that will probably be quite interesting.
That's the thing. I mean, you actually start putting some teeth into these sorts of, you know, regulators' briefs and scope. And all of a sudden, if you're the guy who's, you know, responsible at some sort of senior level for security and you know about something that's gone on, you know, you have to pass it up the chain or you're going to wind up in seven different kinds of shit.
Yeah. And I, you know, this is really good. This is a good thing. This is the, exactly the sort of thing we've been asking for in the industry for a long time with, data breach disclosure laws. And certainly, you know, if we're extending that towards, you know, potential or possible or, you know, things we might know about, then that's, you know, this is good. This is a good thing. And even if nothing else comes out of it, other than we get better data about how much people are getting owned, you know, that will help.
Yeah, that occurred to me as well. And, you know, sort of push the discussion more into the public domain. So good stuff. Now, a few weeks ago, news broke of a bunch of backup tapes that went missing from the back of a car from a US military contractor. 4.9 million records, including stuff like medical records, I believe. Now the US Department of Defense is facing a $4.9 billion class action lawsuit stemming from the incident. And I guess this led me to think that maybe they're using Dr. Evil as a solicitor. $4.9 billion.
It certainly is a pretty eye-popping number until you read a bit further down and realize that it really is. It's $1,000 per person, 4.9 million people.
Yeah.
And in terms of this being your lab notes and your clinical test reports and prescription information, which apparently was, you know, that's the sort of data that was in there, as well as the regular, you know, enough to get you identity thieved. That's actually not a lot of money, right? $1,000, you know, for exposing you to ID theft and
Social security number, address, phone numbers. Health stuff like clinical notes, lab test reports, and prescription information.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty serious biz, and all of a sudden the 4.9 billion actually doesn't seem quite so Dr. Evil outlandish.
And it's the United States too, so if they run out of money or they don't have it, they'll just print some more.
well, yeah. And that, but now, really, you know, if you're responsible for looking after this kind of data, you know, really, you got to start worrying when numbers like this are being thrown around. You know, shipping information around in the clear, it's just not good enough anymore.
No, it is not. Now, we've covered the beast attacks on the show over the last few weeks. They were the SSL kind of man in the middle tricky attacks by Tai Duong and Giuliano Rizzo. There's been some interesting comments surfaced this week from a bloke who was the SSL champion at Netscape. His name's Taher Elgamal. And he basically came out and said, look, this attack is extremely clever, but really, it's not necessarily something that's likely to be used by attackers, and it did get a little bit overhyped. So he was basically coming out and saying, guys, you know, kudos, really smart stuff, but let's not act like this is actually, you know, a really pressing issue in security when there's so many other more serious ones.
And I think that's a very fair assessment of it. I mean, the attack is very clever, like it's extremely cunning, but the set of requirements that you have for actually carrying it out in the real world, like, you know, you're limited to browsers that support WebSockets, but not TLS 1.1 and not new WebSockets, right? Which really leaves you with like a few editions of Safari, you know, and not a whole bunch else. So, I mean, you know, I think Elgamal really, you know, hit the nail on the head. Like it is a very, very clever, very cool, very interesting attack. And it will be used, I think, you know, as an example of how to weaponize, you know, fairly obscure bugs in crypto systems in a practical way. But there's a difference between practical in terms of, you know, cryptanalysis and attacks against implementations of crypto systems and the sort of thing that, you know, Russian crime are going to use in the, you know, in the real world to steal your monies.
Now, speaking of real world attacks, good old SQL injection, man. There's been a SQL injection attack, like one of those mass sort of sprays that's apparently hosed 1 million sites.
Although it's not particularly clear whether that's 1 million actual boxes or whether it's, you know, 1 million virtual hosted things that are getting attacked, getting the mass hosting providers attacked, and, you know, they're hosting 100,000 sites each or something,
which wouldn't be particularly surprising.
Still, it's a lot of boxes, and, you know, every one of those things probably does have a database full of somebody's personal information and credit cards and CVVs, because the sort of people who get popped by this sort of bug are not going to have good policies around the rest of their data, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think they're just using it to, they're using the boxes to host malware, though.
Yeah, but I mean, if they, you know, you own a million boxes, you know, you're going to monetize them the easy way first. And then once that's starting to get a bit boring, then you can go mine for other useful things that are in there, right? And say you lose half of your million boxes, you know, during your malware hosting and your DOSing or whatever. And then you use the other half a million for something else.
But you would admit that's mass pwnage.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. A million of anything is mass pwnage, yes.
Yes, it is. Now, interesting report that came to us via Fairfax newspapers that says the, basically, long story short, the camera system, the actual physical security surveillance camera system at Australia's Parliament House, which was installed there on a $7 million contract from the defence contractor BAE, is basically a big insecure pile of shit that's been attacked in the past. Hooray!
I know. I'm particularly shocked. But no, really, like, it's, we've passed the point where you can deploy this sort of shit in a while in an environment like a parliament and not have people notice that you f***ed it up, right? You just don't get to do that anymore. And so really no sympathy for BAE or whoever the hell else is involved with this particular cluster f***. And, you know, f***ing morons.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because BAE, of course, acquired Australia's largest information security company, StratSec. So I guess maybe those guys weren't involved in this particular contract. What is interesting is apparently the consoles that were used to control the cameras were connected to the internet. That's win number one. And all of this actually came to light during a parliamentary estimates hearing when there were a couple of questions asked of Defence Department types. And, yeah, one of the senators actually referred to some confidential BAE advice that a system failure had been caused by, and I'm quoting, external influences. Someone actually wound up pressing him on the meaning of external influences. And the reply was, oh, it's an area that's a little bit technical. And then the question was, is this a hacking issue? And after a pause of several seconds, they said, I understand it may be. So it looks like someone had a bit of fun with the camera system at Australian Parliament House. Hooray.
Yeah, and I gather this wasn't just cameras. This also included environmental controls and like door control systems. And like, it was the whole building control system, not just like, you know, a couple of webcams or something.
You can imagine getting drunk enough to actually have fun with that, can't you?
Unfortunately, yes.
So I wonder if that's what it was. It was some bored bearded dude out there just going, man, look at this, I'm making the door open, I'm making the door close, anyway,
that would never happen.
It's far-fetched. Just extremely quickly, McAfee has actually released its first DeepSafe product. It always sounds a little bit, ooh, DeepSafe, you know. They've released their first DeepSafe product, which is their sort of more, you know, it's going to be their AV product that uses more hardware features. Pretty interesting. I guess it's perhaps a bit of a milestone depending on how successful the technology is going to be.
Well, yeah, and especially because, you know, people are predicting that moving this kind of, you know, AV functionality up into the hypervisor was something that was going to happen more and more. And I can see some of the reasons why you want to do that. But I just don't think it's a particularly good idea personally. And as you say, like the name, even the name is bad. Like seriously, McAfee DeepSafe Deep Defender, really?
It's a little bit redundant.
Well, yeah, exactly. And really, do we think that another security product is really going to solve all the problems in the same way that their marketing would like us to believe? And I was reading this.
It could be a step in the right direction, though. But I think DeepSafe, what is it? Deep Protect? It should be. It should have a tagline that says, it's deep.
And they also have the management thing, which is the, what is it? The Deep Command. So they have the EPO Deep Command, which is the amount of the McAfee like e-policy orchestrator, which by the way, if you'd like to go and look at the vulnerability history of, it's f***ing awful. You know, like format strings bugs in the year 2008, seriously, guys. But yeah, so let's deploy some more vendor crapware even further, you know, down into your hardware, and that's going to make things way better. Go McAfee.
Cynical? You? Never!
Seriously.
Now, we've got three items here that we're just going to quickly mention. You know, it seems every week a new sort of executive, a different executive in the United States is being doxed. This week, it was the Citigroup CEO who had some personal information, just some stuff like, you know, phone numbers, email addresses, addresses, family information, bit of legal and financial info. That's cabin crew. They dropped that. Ties in with the whole Occupy Wall Street thing. NoScript is now available on the Android platform, which I think is an interesting little development. Isn't it great that we have to have security applications that hobble the functionality of our browsers so that we can actually sleep at night? Hooray. And Google now is offering encrypted web search by default for signed-in users, which I think is an interesting trend. I mean, this is the post-FireSheep trend of everyone to encrypt the absolute crap out of everything. But I wanted to end this week's news with an interesting report, not really traditional security fare, but David Kravitz of Wired has written a very interesting piece about jailbreaking and about how Apple was screaming, like 2 or 3 years ago, they were screaming blue murder, that if people were allowed to jailbreak phones, then their business model would crumble, their share price would go into the toilet, the world would end, rivers would turn to blood, you know, that sort of thing. And this piece just very succinctly points out that their share price has something like tripled in the last few years. And now Apple's actually starting to implement features that were first created by jailbreakers.
Yeah, it is a very prescient piece, I think. It's very good to look back at it, the exact arguments Apple was using during the jailbreaking debate, and then really nothing of the things that they were complaining about has happened. I think perhaps it is a bit of a stretch to suggest that Apple's implementing features in iOS 5 specifically because jailbreakers developed them and tested them first. They implemented cut and paste, the jailbreakers, before Apple did too. But I don't really think that was what pushed Apple to implement cut and paste, because everyone was like, excuse me, no cut and paste.
Yeah. Well, what about the camera from the camera is now accessible from the locked screen, things like that. I mean, just little ideas. It's not really the point anyway. The point is that they lost that particular battle and the sky didn't fall in. So now there's apparently some hearings coming up which are going to determine if there should be a similar exemption, because in the US, it is entirely legal to jailbreak a phone, but not a gaming console, as GeoHot discovered. So there is now a bit of a push on for that sort of freedom to be afforded to games console tinkers. And that could be very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that this particular story, about what's happened to Apple since they made that argument, I think it should be a really central piece of the debate about what happens with the game consoles. And then, of course, there is also the fact that the Apple platform is a gaming console these days as well, and it makes no sense to be able to jailbreak one gaming platform and not the other just because it happens to also be a phone. Ship Skype with your Xbox and then we'll call it a phone, right? And then we can jailbreak.
I like it. All right, Adam, we're actually out of time. Thank you so much for joining us to discuss this week's news and the wonderful, wonderful developments in the First State Superannuation.
Yeah, dicks.
But thank you, mate, and we'll chat to you again next week.
And cheers, pal. I'll talk to you then.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. This week's episode of Risky Business is unsponsored. If your company would like to consider sponsoring Risky Business, please email me, patrick@risky.biz. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Ian de Villiers of the South African security firm SensePost. Ian recently dropped a couple of very interesting SAP security tools at 44Con in London and ZACON in South Africa. SAP makes enterprise resource planning solutions, CRM, SCM, PLM, all of those three-letter clunky, thick client enterprise thingies. It's everywhere. And as it turns out, one of the only things that has saved SAP from thorough examination in the past has been the relative obscurity of its protocol. Well, Ian, extending the work of Ukrainian security guy Denis Yurichev, has written a couple of tools that will let you play around with SAP software and the SAP protocol. He's written a protocol decoder, SAPCAP, which is sort of like, think of it as PCAP for SAP stuff, and SAPROX, which Ian describes as being like WebScarab for the SAP protocol. He joined the show via Skype from South Africa, and here's what he had to say.
I actually started this in April, April or May. I came across on Dennis's stuff, and then obviously I don't have a lot of research time. Most of the time I am actually on project or training or something like that. So it's sort of been fitted in over weekends and after hours, and I'm rather happy with the results in the couple of months I've had.
What are people typically asked to do when they're auditing SAP systems? I mean, is this a big discipline?
It is a big discipline. I'm actually probably not the completely correct person to ask. I mean, you've got the guys at Anapsys and stuff like Hoops and ERP Scan and all of these guys who focus specifically on SAP. Most of the time, I'm not necessarily auditing SAP systems. I'm auditing something else, but we come across it. So I mean, obviously, you've got Anapsys with their SAP vulnerability scanners and stuff like that, and they look at specific configuration issues and all of that. Why I thought I'd take a different approach is that everybody seems to be looking for vulnerabilities on SAP systems, and they seem to be digging at the Java and the NetWeaver J2E engine, et cetera, but very little seems to be actually being seems to be done in terms of the SAP GUI and SAP Diag, and actually looking at how all of that fits together.
Now, it is a typical thick client application in that it's, from what I understand, it's a bit of a nightmare. It's not been put together particularly well. I mean, do you think that's a fair assessment?
It's very accurate, but I can also understand how things have sort of run, because I think originally SAP came out, and it's just been added onto ever since. And obviously, you've got all these hundreds of different versions of clients with different feature sets, which have to communicate with all the different versions of the server systems, et cetera, et cetera. So it's rather problematic.
And what does the protocol look like? From what I understand, it's just a compressed, unencrypted protocol. Is that right?
Yes, it's a compressed protocol. It uses a variant of LimpelZiv compression, two variants actually. With a bunch of headers which get added on. When these get decompressed, you've got a couple of different sort of standard messages, and they sort of differ in terms of the direction, whether they're going from the GUI to the SAP server or vice versa. Where things get very, very interesting is more complex message types actually start containing additional compressed streams inside the actual message. And these all hook up together to actually, this is literally what makes SAP perform specific functionality. It's very, very interesting. I'm not sure if you read my slides, but you've got a sort of bunch of structures, like you've got one called params, one called vars, one called verbs. And since SAP GUI was traditionally written for Windows systems, a large bunch of this is COM orientated. So you'd literally have these structures instantiating COM objects on the SAP GUI on the client, and invoking functionality from that, which actually looks reasonably frightening when you see the protocol on the wire. But it's very, very interesting.
So what were the challenges involved in actually reversing the protocol to begin with? How opaque was it?
It's reasonably tricky, because there's virtually no documentation out there. I'm still spending quite a lot of time trying to figure out more, because obviously the research I published is just the start of a bunch of stuff. But it's reasonably tricky, and specifically there is no documentation. You can get documentation from SAP, but you'll have to sign your life away in the form of a non-disclosure agreement.
Yes, they will require in their vaults the deposit of two of your children for their peace of mind.
Quite, yes. <yeah. laughs> But yeah, so it's complex to actually go through and try and work out exactly what's going on, specifically because the versions of SAP servers and GUI differ all the time. Also, the Java GUI, they've got some sort of bastardized COM functionality in all they've written just to support the sort of way the protocol works.
What sort of classes of bugs can you then probe for, I guess, once you have a better understanding of the protocol? And you've created a a protocol interceptor or decoder, and you've also got a proxy. So say you're using the proxy. I mean, you're in the middle of all of this traffic. What sort of stuff can you then start to do?
There's some frightening issues which come up, and it's one of the things why I've sort of referred to my proxy more or less as web scarab for SAP, because the majority of if you can say sort of web application vulnerability categories, things like authorization, authentication, state management, validation, all seem to be present in SAP applications as well. So replay is also frightening, but for example, in some cases, it's possible prior to authentication to actually get ABAP to generate a dump and literally go through and because the ABAP engine is reasonably unstable at that point, to actually literally go along and invoke the debugger prior to authentication. It's not perfectly, it doesn't work perfectly because not all the memory structures are in place, so the debugger is not fully functional, but it still bears a lot of digging. They're client-side attacks. The code execution, it's really ridiculously easy to execute code on SAP clients. And because obviously, as I was sort of mentioning, you've got these params, verbs, and vars which fit together to invoke functionality on the client, they're also present in requests to the server. So I think it will probably also be theoretically possible. It's still stuff I'm poking at the moment, but to actually obtain similar sort of execute commands basically on the SAP server, but that's still something I'm digging through.
Does that depend on the customer's implementation, or are you talking about problems with the SAP software itself? Or are you talking about, I mean, because I imagine there's a level of customization that's quite high, so that, you know, each SAP installation is almost like a web application installation, in that it's, you know, because the functionality is so customized, it's almost like it's actually created from, each application is created from scratch. Is that right, or is SAP more of an out-of-the-box proposition?
It's probably correct to some degree, but I think the protocol itself remains reasonably static. It's reasonably standard. It's the way the GUI. So I mean, when you develop or customize the SAP system, it actually doesn't really have too much of a difference in the way that the data gets transmitted between the client and the server, and how the responses work. So,
even in the case of things like logic and state bugs, I mean, is that the case that they're going to be just in off-the-shelf SAP applications, or?
Yes, one of the state bugs I've currently got is actually off-the-shelf SAP with absolutely no configuration or customization at all. So, I think it's just that nobody's really poked at it to too much of an extent before.
So basically, you're just giving this thing a little nudge and shells are flying out left, right, and center. Well, maybe not shells, but, you know, you can actually quite easily execute commands both on the client. Well, you were talking about code execution on the client. Do you mean actual
execution on the client? Actual popcalc.exe, the hello world of exploit writers. Okay, obviously there are differences as well, because one of the things I mentioned earlier, you've got all of these SAP, obviously, when they generate a new version of SAP GUI, they've got to make sure that it's still compatible with older versions of the SAP server. So you've got a whole bunch of ABAP methods for invoking commands on SAP clients, which have been deprecated, but newer clients still support the old manner of executing stuff. In mitigation, they do actually prompt when you execute commands. The interesting part about this is once again, because of the sort of COM-based nature of the client, the SAP GUI client, you can literally go along and instantiate ActiveX controls or COM objects on the client. And there's a whole bunch of COM objects that's installed by default with SAP, which contain some very, very, very dodgy methods. The only thing which saves them normally is that they're not flagged as safe for scripting, so it's not possible to instantiate them in a web browser or something like that, but it's possible to instantiate them in SAP without it even prompting the user. So it literally sort of opens up a channel that there hasn't been before. And then obviously, as I was sort of saying, I've currently been looking at that quite a bit, but because of the way the params, verbs, and bars get passed from the client back to the server as well, I imagine that's what I'm currently busy looking at the moment, but I imagine it would actually be possible to do the same thing back at the server.
So you're talking about actual code execution?
Code execution, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about these tools? You've written two. Walk us through each one.
Firstly, I've got to give big shouts out to Denis Yurichev, because obviously the stuff I've done is based very much on his work. But they're basically two tools. They both use the sort of custom JNI interface, which is obviously based on MaxDB code for handling the compression and the decompression of the stream. But firstly, there's SAP PCAP, which is a packet sniffer for SAP. So previously with SAP sniffing the SAP traffic, there were basically two options for decompressing it. The one way was published by some guys from Securon in 2009, and literally dealt with playing captured traffic back to SAP GUI and using that to decompress the information, and you'd access that out of the debugger, which obviously is particularly painstaking. Dennis's work, he wrote a utility, but what you'd have to do is you'd have to go along and capture all the packets and string all the data together, and only then could you go along and decompress it. So it was also quite painstaking and time consuming. So SAP PCAP is basically just a easy to use packet sniffer for SAP and decoder. It's based on a third-party PCAP library, so it'll sniff directly off the network. You'll be able to load a Wireshark dump file. You'll be able to use your standard PCAP filters. And then the second one is SAP Prox, which is just a proxy application. Fire it up, you point SAP GUI at your SAP Prox, and you'll literally be able to tamper with the stream going from SAP GUI to the server and back again.
And that's where the fun begins.
That's where the fun begins. And there's a lot of fun. There's just so much to look at that it gets almost confusing quite frequently. SAP Prox also has a nice scripting utility. You can literally write a script in a language of your choice, Ruby or Python or whatever. You just have to make sure that the corresponding interpreter jar file is on the class path. And it just sort of makes it a little bit easier. So some of the canned exploits I'm busy working on are Python-based scripts, which I can instantiate in the proxy.
So, I mean, are you reporting any of this stuff back to SAP, or are you just like, haha, no free bugs?
The stuff I found, I've reported back to SAP.
Do you reckon they might just go get stuffed and then SSL everything, and then you're kind of screwed?
Yeah, well, if you have a look at the timeline, they've sort of mentioned they're actually bringing out a free SNC library, which will be included as part of the NetWeaver license. That'll be out, they said, October or November this year. So I find it funny with Dennis's research being published last year, and now all of a sudden you're getting this. They've sort of changed the business model for SNC. But
what is SNC? What is that? Just like secure network communication or something?
Yeah, secure network communication. That's SAP's answer in terms of this unencrypted algorithm type.
So hang on, they've changed the licensing, but they haven't actually made it a default option.
It's not a default option.
Then you're fine. Don't worry.
What I find interesting about it, though, is it'll save the sniffing problem. So it'll stop people from arbitrarily, obviously, depending on how well implemented the encryption algorithms are. I mean, if they've made mistakes over there, then they're still going to have issues. But in any case, it'll save the SAP systems from attacks as a result of arbitrary sniffing of the network, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting part about it is because it's a library, I imagine it's still going to be possible to actually use that and plug it into the proxy. And provided you have got your creds for the SAP system, you'll probably be able to still get into the stream. But obviously, I haven't seen that yet, so I haven't had a chance to play.
It would depend on how they implement it, though, wouldn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
Alrighty, well, Ian de Villiers, thank you so much for speaking to Risky Business.
Thank you very much for your time, and all the best that side.
Funny how we talk so loud when there's nothing left to say. I just can't believe that things have ended up this way. Tokyo keeps moving like nobody knows the time. Still too slow for letting go of angels left behind. It never
Ian de Villiers of SensePost there with a look at SAP security. And that is it for this week's show. Big thanks to our hosting provider, Virtual Office, that is OFFIS. And this week's track is actually by a friend of mine. His name is Lloyd Spiegel. He's a pretty amazing guitar player, actually, and well worth seeing live. He actually toured with B.B. King a very long time ago, but you don't tour with B.B. King if you're useless. This song is called Letter from Tokyo, and you can actually get it on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Swear I've been in love before. I've never known that much for sure. If home is where the heart is, it lies behind your door. I lost it all and found myself at home inside these walls. If home is where the heart is, there's nothing left to see. I lock the door and throw away my key. Funny how we're breaking things we're never gonna fix, as I just keep allowing my emotions to be mixed. I learned my lesson long ago, you can't win with the rules. You can try to make it foolproof, they'll just build a better fool. I'm always twisting lies to make them true. And gone. As I decided long ago, I'd never wait that long. My body's working overtime, clouded minds won't clear. With everybody telling me the things I want to hear, I'm always twisting lies to make them true. I never took my mind right off of you. I've been lost for so long now, I figured there was no way out. If home is where the heart is, it lies behind your door. I lost it all and found myself at home inside these walls. If home is where the heart is, there's nothing left to see. I locked the door and threw away my key.